Thank you so much, Deanna, for that warm welcome and for your exquisite organization of this event. I just want to say thank you very much. And to all of you for coming out through the icy cold wind tonight to hear some poetry. I first met Carolyn Vandermeer. It's a real pleasure to be reading with Carolyn here tonight. We actually know each other, which doesn't always happen at the Atwater Poetry Project. But I'm of Dutch ancestry. My father was born in Amsterdam right at the end of the Second World War. And I came out to hear Carolyn read about Motherlode, and we became fast friends through sharing about our mutual Dutch ancestry. So it's a real pleasure to share the stage with her. So I'm going to read to you tonight from Small Fires, my first collection of poems. And Small Fires is a book of journeys. It traverses different landscapes. Some of them are literary, as in the landscape of the work of Paul Manet that Deanna mentioned. And one of the chief landscapes that I describe is Inishmore. In 2001, for the very first time, I visited the island of Inishmore. It's one of the three Aran Islands off the west coast of County Galway, Ireland. And it's an Irish-speaking island, which is quite a rare thing. Irish is the first language that's taught to the children in the elementary schools. And at a certain time, it was also one of the key places in the early Christian world. So it was a place of pilgrimage as important as Jerusalem. And this is a small island. It's 9 miles long and 4 miles wide. It's a place where, to me, landscape has a lot of depth. And as I was thinking about the selection of poems I would read to you tonight, I was just thinking about the three layers of landscape that I noticed when I was on the island. There's the physical landscape, which is the sea and the sky and the limestone fields and the green grass. And then you have the historical landscape. It's a place where you can see ruins from 6th-century churches and monastic sites jutting up out of the earth. There's also a large pre-Christian history. There are 5,000-year-old ring forts on the island as well. So whenever you walk on the island, you're just aware of history. And then there's the mythological landscape as well. When I was there, I heard many stories, and sometimes I wasn't sure if they were fact or fiction or a blend of the two. They could have been legends transposed from another place in another time, but all of those together were what impacted me on the island. So I'm going to share some of that with you tonight. This first poem I consider an invocation and a welcome to the island. It's called At the Seven Churches, and in Irish, Na Seachtaí de Temple. Clochan, like a bell turned inward, sound of the wind in the fields, no prayers, no mass, only cows in the winter making their rounds. We come to kneel at the doorway, to peer into that kind of dark, to think our way backwards, listening. This next poem was written on Inishmore one night when I was walking home from my friend Noni's house, and I was surprised by a very large nocturnal bird. It's called Night on the Dark Earth. Feet pad black air down the Scrugeen Road, laying a velvet trail beside my own. A stoat trawls in and out of holes in a stone wall, lives between the earth's core and the shores of 4,000 years ago. What does the stoat know of time? Night is salt and the blood of earthworms bruising on the rain-damp floor. Sniffs the air, flashes down its dark hole where time is stunned asleep beside a pile of bloodied feathers. Dead languages of birds leap out into the frozen night, call the old call to Earth's shadowed cell. Night birds flicker through the passages of old men's sleep. Nothing changes. A goat's gold eye strips a hedge. The ivy grows thick. Trees are lungs, gills dripping rain, loneliness a fog to see through, a rain-torn path. A heron lifts its wings, rose through blue-black sky. Slowly, the dark earth turns. While I was living on Inishmore, and my time on the island lasted 8 months, so just short of a year, I was lucky enough to be lent a beautiful stone house by a couple who were going away just at harvest time. They had a garden, so every day I would get to pick vegetables from their organic garden. And it was also across the road from a beach called Killeany Beach. And I was told this story by my friend, and when I asked her about it later, when I was actually fact-checking for this book, she could not confirm that it was actually true. So this might be a true story, and it also might be sort of an admonition and a warning against walking out too far at low tide. It's called Killeany Beach. Two priests were lost here, buried alive. The thick mud of low tide turned to quicksand. Over the dunes, dark sand a wound, the sea drawn back, bright sheet of water, they pass through, robes torn by wind, a warning. Heedless, they sank. Prayer, a cry of hunger, even as the world dissolved them. Now, lovers shelter here, gather kisses in the hollows of their throats. On the cusp of wave and field, their hair like flames upon the grass. This next poem is set at that same beach, Killeany Beach. I stayed at the stone house throughout a long, cold, dark Irish winter, and I would actually swim in that beach up until the month of October, and that's when it got too cold for me and I stopped. But I would continue to take my walks there, and there was a woman who kept swimming throughout the winter. I would see her go in the afternoon, and she seemed not only to be oblivious to the cold, she seemed to be completely embraced by it. And I would watch her from afar, and we had a sort of nodding relationship. I didn't want to get too close into her space and even disturb her. But what I saw from her was a strong relationship with the land and with her environment, and a complete immersion in the winter ocean. Her name was Neve. You go down deep, touch the white pelt of winter ocean, stroke the sand that rolls like bear fur, white-edged softness of loosed minerals, hair from the shore, seaweed bands, cold mouths around your burnt and salted skin. You swim every winter's day. The ocean calls your feet to make their way to the violet mouth of foam and periwinkles. You feel them, clipped and silvered under the ocean's shell, for cold makes us immune to slights and slivers. A sliced toe on beach glass blooms to anemones beneath the ocean's skin, 4 months of slicing open winter's white-capped belly sliding in. Once I saw you swim, an otter or a winter bear, and stopped myself, for why does woman become some other animal when she enters winter water? Hair curly and gold-tipped with salt and frost. Neve, you move slowly, shoulders rounded, fleshy pink. And if I painted you another way, if I only said you lived alone, cuticles raw with coal dust, I'd be forcing emptiness into your days that isn't there. For the ocean's mouth barbed with blue and seagrass moving soundlessly across your feet receive you, free of flesh and time, swimming out to meet the waves as all sea creatures do. There was also a really strong musical culture on Inishmore, and as I stuck around for about 8 months, people came to know me, but I didn't quite feel like an insider. I wasn't living there. I was what you would consider a blow-in, somebody who's there temporarily. But I did go down to a session at one of the pubs all the time, and I would sort of sit at the edge of the circle of musicians, kind of looking in, wanting to be included. And then one night, one of the drummers must have been sensitive to that, so he opened the circle and invited me in, and this is a poem about that experience. It's called The Bowron Player, after the Bowron drum. The Bowron is a belly that he brushes with the knuckles of a drumstick, threads the blood's rhythm, thrums the blood's river, clutches the drum as shy men do, dearer than he'd hold a woman. Rocks in his chair, caught in the amber glance of glasses on tables. listens for the piper to unlock the gimp of the reel. It scampers out between rocks and he follows it, stutters his answer low to the ground where the shrew dives down its hole, reels off, spitting words we can't follow, chased by the tapping of heels. Then he hands me the drum like a question. I run the bones over tight goat skin, smell of dry grass loosened by water, on through the ring of smoke and sweat, faces fade and reappear, until rhythm is a small wild creature in my hands, stroking the dark cheek of the world. And I never learned his name, but he was extremely kind and generous. I had another musician friend on the island who was from Germany. His name was Matthias, and one day some of us were sitting around and he was teaching us a folk song. It was called Es saß ein klein wild Vögelein. And we thought it was a fairly innocent song about a bird on a branch, and then we started listening and realizing that it had a whole deeper and sadder level, and it was about the old practice of first night or prime noctis, practiced by unsavory land owners and seigneurs. This poem is called The Wild Bird Song. Matthias sits with his guitar, tuning strings back to the Schwarzwald. Under the canopy, boughs that bend heavy, finds the song left by his ancestors. Once, a wild bird sat on a branch, sang for herself alone. A rich man, wrapped in his thick fur cloak, offered silk and gold if she would sing for his pleasure. The young bird flew to the farthest field, sang through the winter's night, until hoarfrost bound her, foot and wing. There, if you look, lying bleached among stones, are the bones of farmers' daughters fled from their villages. Fathers would not look. They took the parcels, silken shirts and hair combs tied with string, stamped their anger into the ground, planted root vegetables far down where winter could not touch them. So sing for those who lay down with their masters, sing for those who flew, who rest beyond the steepled towns, and sing for no one. And this is the last poem I'll read you from the Inishmore series. At a certain point on the island, I was living on the eastern end, and some friends of mine were living in the center. And the island is only 9 miles long, so you would think that would be a big deal, but there was often horizontal rain, darkness at 4 p.m., so it was quite something to get from friends' houses in the evening. And I used to go to their house, and this is before I knew that you could actually get a headlamp and strap it to your forehead. And I used to have a very small flashlight and I'd put it between my teeth and bike down pitch dark roads. So this is about one of those nights when I was biking home through the dark without a flashlight this time. And I looked up and I saw the stars above me and I remembered the stories that are recorded in the stars. It's called The Hunter's Path. Oil dark road below my bicycle wheels, I pass beneath his blue window, taking the Pleiades with me on this journey home. The seven sisters turn to doves, fall through black-winged sky, cross oceans, islands, olive groves, while Orion trails behind them. Always, the god comes to steal away the innocent who tarries on the hunter's path. At night, the landscapes blur to one topography, where the face of the god looms to pull me to his Hades or his blue room. The youngest Pleiad stalled mid-flight, one tail feather caught in the gates of eternity. Her sisters died with her amid the star belt. Now, seven points of light remind us, constant flight is difficult, though picturesque. Calling us to race the wind, they shiver high up, defying destiny with one tail feather. At my gate, I stop, breathe sharp iron air. The lights are out, doors locked. Desire sears its nightly trail among the fixed cold bodies, while the hunter gleams in his darkness far behind. So after my 8 months on Inishmore were over, I actually didn't want to leave the island, but I was there at a particular time, right before the tourist season begins, where there's absolutely no work to be had, and I knew I wanted to stay in Europe, so I applied to a language school in France, and I got a job at a tiny colonie de vacances in the Midi Pyrenees. We were staying in a village that had a population of 50, so with the students and the teachers, we actually tripled the population of the village. And most of the time, the only company I had were my students and my fellow teachers. But one morning, I was taking a walk with a fellow teacher, and we got invited in by a neighbor. So an actual real person from the community talked to us and invited us in for a drink. So I was incredibly excited. So we went in, but on her wall was a giant boar's head, and right next to it, a black and white photograph of her husband with the dead boar completely stretched out and dead. So all I could do was sip my cassis and stare at this majestic animal that had been killed. So that was my encounter with the neighbors, and this poem came out of it. It's called The Wild Boar. Rooting down, star-nosed, snuffling for grubs, breasts wet with the gelatin of milk, she is a muted sow, a warrior, still dark animal, cloven. Her tusks, wild as rose bushes, plunge in, slicing, then out from the current, intact, scent of blood, wild yarrow in the air. When he shoots her, one thought, clear as a pellet in the center of her mind, is a crashing back to the scented herd, charging slowly through her own blood. Now she hangs, still furious, on the wall, monstrous in her beauty. Her eyes of glass have forgotten the place she was running to. And the last poem I'm going to read to you tonight is a longer poem. It's also set in France, but this time in Lyon. At a certain time, I was transferred from my little village in the Pyrenees to another small village that was about an hour and a half outside of Lyon. So on my breaks to escape the chaos of the language school and the teenagers, I would come to Lyon for the weekend. And one weekend I was staying in a hotel, and I had learned that Lyon was one of the most important places of the silk industry in Europe. And there was a tour that was going on, and I rushed to the tourist office, and I got there and I realized that I'd missed the tour. So instead of going on a tour, they offered me a piece of paper, and it turned out to be actually better than the tour. It had all of these addresses on it, and they were the addresses of these things called traboules, which are passageways that the silk workers would use to transport the silk through the city so that it wouldn't be damaged by the sun. So there I was by myself, taking myself on a self-tour with this page of addresses, and the doorways to the traboules, they just look like ordinary doorways, except you push on them and you enter passageways, and some of them were clogged with junk, and some of them were open and free, and I also learned that they were used as hiding places during the Second World War. So that same afternoon, after spending this whole afternoon looking at the traboules, I sat down on the steps of a church that's mentioned in this poem, and I sketched out the very beginnings of this poem, and then 3 years later I came out with the final version, which you're going to hear. So the poem is called The Silken Threads, and it starts with an epigraph that's written by the historian Erica Budd from her project Silk in Lyon. It goes, "Economic antagonisms exist in nearly every labor movement, yet something else happens that sets the movement in motion. In Lyon, it was the working conditions. Air was not circulated, as windows were vehemently prohibited from being opened. There were even tunnels leading from building to building so that the silk would never be exposed to the outside air during manufacturing." The Silken Threads. There is a beating of wings when you shift in the sheets. Moth's breath rustles the curtains. In the front room, the loom waits, lewd giant, hungry for your fingers, the lean of your shoulder over the grain of the cloth. The warp and weft unbroken, your eyes locked in secret patterns of paisley damask as a griffin floats across the screen. Braiding and unbraiding the silken threads, your eyes are glossed as whetstones, bluer than dye. Dawn spills, russet as the blood of weavers. Soon you will stir, rise, one thin stem of wheat among a field of others. Across quos, all wake in narrow rooms, swaying. Cough, the rattle cough, the lungs pulleys dipped in ash, coated with the raw dust of the cloth. You move to the wash basin, soap skin the color of wax, sip strong tea, and begin the tapping of the loom. It spins and cords the muscles tight across your back, your arms as heavy as wet branches. Hours blend as strings of sunlight scale the window. When the room is dark, you stumble into bed. Only our words of loving still the sound of the loom before the great silk curtain of sleep lowers you with vermilion, russet, and gold to that dim place, the island in the sea of exhaustion. Our son, 14 years old and gone. Silk loom gnarled his hands, hands that have loved no woman but know the cloth like the lover's nape, caught midstream in a bath and slipping under soft petaled water. His gelid stare as he left, one who walks with no destination, trained from birth for the trade, as the tree bent under brutal winds knows only to grow one way. The streets are ropes of jute thick with mud. In the rugged district, weavers shiver outside dormitories. In the slats of sunlight stolen between shifts, men smoke on doorsteps, stoke their anger. A second storm is brewing over Quarus, they say. Some squint and glance at the street, remember themselves with raised fists and the National Guard in clothing red and blazing. Women rub tired hands over yellow eyes. When we strike again, let them come. More fire for the furnace of hatred that broils this season. In airless rooms, the colors spin on. Merchants from Versailles command them from the bent back child's fingers, a small figure braiding yellows that set the sallow walls alight. Rose tendrils climb the trellis of the loom as an old man bleeds into a brocade for some clergyman's sitting room in Vienna. In the salon, the dyes run green as if new gods have spilt their blood and blue from the tears of fishes. Monsieur Michel takes the bundle from my hands and pays us his pittance. The merchant's eyes, round as black soot, take in the redness of my hands, the darkness of the room, the slow fire of the loom burning our thoughts to crimson ends. Our children know the spectrum slide from red to mauve before they know words. We pluck patterns like birds from the air and fasten them with string. Beneath the city's damp belly, we tunnel, sheltering our bright burdens from the teeth of rain, the bleaching sun. Silk has a look of skin. It is a live thing, stolen threads that remember a living worm in its dying chamber, a loose-fitting cloak passed from moths to kings. It has the curves of a body, the weight of a sleeping child. It passes like water out of our hands. A riot of leaves blows across the courtyard. Wind's fingers brush the back of our hands while we wait in the stillness. Across the city, the looms are abandoned like dishes after a banquet of blood and dye. The young men stream like mice from the darkness, soon to erupt in the streets. In the Vieille Ville, horses' hooves dance metallic over cobblestones, silver-bitten gray gleaming church steps, the sandstone face of Saint-Jean's Cathedral, burnt clay of a doorway, a shopkeeper on Rue Juivry keeping time with his broom. The tinkling bells of a door open, brown shoes scuffle in, silver coins are exchanged for a loaf of bread, a sack of flour, a flea-bitten dog outside St. Paul's battles flies with his gray ears. These are the colors of the day. We drink them heavily like sweet brown tea these few hours before the marshals and the blockades and the shrieking colors that beg to be woven. There are spaces we make for ourselves between shadow and sunlight, rare threads pulled from the skein of darkness. When your fingers sift through the loose strands of my hair and clothing falls from us like dead sheaves revealing the living fiber of the skin, I know this is the light we must choose to live by. Even the night enfolds our bodies in its finest silken sheets. Thank you very much.